Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today I'm the guest as well. We're going to be discussing your questions, and let me tell you my interests. I'll try to do my best to answer any and all questions that come in, or at least point you in the right direction. I have particular interest in pediatrics since I'm practicing pediatrics for 30 years. Very big interest in asthma and allergy because it's a big part of what I do every day. I've been more and more interested in efforts to improve our healthcare system and why we need to make some changes. And I'm also very, very interested in improving public understanding of science, what science is all about, what's good about science, what's not so good about science. But as I said, I'll be glad to answer any and all of your questions. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I'm going to take a couple of emails that came in already to start the show. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. You can also call us during this program at 550-8433. That's our direct number in Anchorage, 550-8433. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And I'll give it to you one more time, 1-888-353-5752. So today, treat me nicely, but give me your questions and comments, and let's see where we can go. I'm going to take the first email that came in from a listener named Mark. He has two questions, and he wants to know if I could explain what the two numbers on the blood pressure reading refer to. There's two numbers, the systolic and diastolic pressure. The systolic pressure is the maximum pressure that's reached during a recording of blood pressure in the arm or the leg, and the diastolic pressure, the bottom number, is the lowest recorded pressure. Really, the two numbers are important. For a long time, we used the diastolic pressure as the most important. That is kind of the lowest pressure that's always present in blood vessels in the arteries. If the blood pressure is higher, then it can cause damage to organs. It makes the heart have to work harder. So that's called hypertension, and now there's been more and more emphasis put on the systolic blood pressure as well, that first number, the highest number that's recorded when you take a blood pressure. There's a lot of factors that determine blood pressure, your tone of your nervous system under stress. It may increase, particularly the systolic blood pressure. Your state of hydration has a little bit of effect. Your kidneys, how they're working, distensibility of the arteries, those arteries that are more hardened and calcified with age or atherosclerosis may not respond as well to pressure. And there's lots of hormones that have effects. So there's a number of factors that control the blood pressure, but hopefully that will answer the number for the information for Mark, systolic and diastolic, and their measures of the arterial blood pressure. The other question he had was regarding female anatomy and wanted to know a little bit about the function of the hymen. You hear a lot about hymen in girls, and maybe you've heard the indication that it can tell whether, if you examine a girl, whether she's had sex or intercourse or not, and that's probably not at all true. He also wants to know whether or not, if it's not broken, how can girls have menstruation safely? How can it flow? The hymen develops during embryologic development of the newborn, of the infant or the fetus, and it thins out and changes size throughout the life of a girl based on lots of factors, particularly hormones. It is not imperforate. There is a hole in the hymen at the beginning. It can vary in size and shape and structure. But an imperforate hymen will cause problems. Twice or three times in the 30 years of being a pediatrician, I've seen newborns born with imperforate hymens. And what happens is mucus backs up behind it. So as Mark implies, there has to be an opening, and there is one, and it's variable sizes. At the time girls have entered puberty and begin to menstruate, there have already been hormonal changes that cause that changes in the hymen. It does not block up anything. What's the function of the hymen? I'm not sure I can really even answer the question. It's just a normal part of the female anatomy. It blocks what's called the introitus, or it's in the introitus. There's the entrance to the vagina past the labia, and then you get into the vaginal introitus, the opening. There's the vagina itself, and then deep in the vagina is the cervix, the bottom part of the of the uterus. So that's the kind of structural questions or answer to Mark's question. We also had a question that came in from Kristen. Kristen wanted to know how many glasses of water you need to drink a day. And this has been answered a lot of times frequently recently. I've heard this question come up. And this is a myth. There is no evidence, no good science behind the idea that you have to have 8 glasses of water a day. I'm not sure where that origin of that comes from, but it's been addressed by specialists a number of times recently that I'm aware of. Your kidneys and your liver are extremely good at filtering out things that need to be filtered and removed from your blood. When you do not have enough urine or enough water, you will automatically decrease the amount of urine that you're making. It will get concentrated and more dark. That's an indication you need to drink more water. If you drink a lot more water, you're just going to pee a lot more. Not that it improves any function. And remember, most of our foods, a large percentage of them are water. I think it's something like 80 to 85, maybe even 90% of fruits and vegetables are still water. There's plenty of water around. So I don't think you have to concentrate on drinking a significant amounts of water. In fact, I don't even think about it. You will automatically drink enough water, I think, for most of us. What will get us in trouble is if we're having increased insensible loss of water, for example, exercising in hot or humid areas where you're evaporating water. If you're breathing a lot faster over a prolonged period of time, you're losing a lot of moisture. Your body will automatically begin to signal you that you need to drink some more water. So I don't think it makes sense that you have to really concentrate on making yourself eat or drink, as I said, that much water. So again, for listeners today, I'm taking calls and questions and trying to do my best to answer any questions or comments that you've got. Let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with me over the next 45 or 50 minutes. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You need to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at alaskapublic.org. And I should remind everyone also, you can go to alaskapublic.org at any time and listen to prior broadcasts, or you can see some links to particular websites that I think are reliable for getting health information as well at alaskapublic.org. Look for the Line 1 link. Here's another email that I have received. The writer would rather remain anonymous here, and this is about a person who this writer knows who seems to be having trouble with possible addiction to pain medications. It seems obvious when she is taking her medications, she acts differently than when she is off of these medications. Her primary physician is not in Anchorage, but she seems to, they think, get her pain medications from a pain doctor here in Anchorage. She has the following question. Should I mind my own business about this? Do doctors in various parts of Alaska have a way to check pharmacy records to be sure patients are not double dipping, that is getting more pain meds, and what do I recommend? So let's take the first question first. Should I mind my own business? And the answer to that is I think no. I think if you are concerned about an individual that may be addicted or overusing or misusing a medication, that you either have to talk with that patient or I don't think it's inappropriate to contact the doctor's office. The doctor's office cannot talk to you about that patient and their problems, or they should not, but they certainly could take that information and act on that information either by contacting the patient themselves or putting a note down to make sure they address it at the next visit with that patient. So my way to answer this question is that you ought to be involved, and I think it's always a good idea if you're going to talk with the patient themselves to express empathy. I am mentioning I am clearly worried. I hope you don't take offense with me talking to you, but this issue, and then you address the issue, is bothering me. One thing I would also say, and I would like to make sure, is that We are taking, I think, a more enlightened view towards pain. We are using more pain medications, and we want to be sure in this particular situation the person does not really need the pain medication and at times does run out and has problems. Some pain is we're willing to accept some addiction because there's nothing else we can do, for example, in an end-of-life situation. So I don't know this more than specifics, but don't automatically jump to the conclusion that pain medications may not be appropriate, but certainly it's worth investigating some more. The other question was, do physicians in various parts of Alaska have a way to check on pharmacy records? Generally, I would answer that is no. It is possible. It's increasingly possible with the use of electronic medical records and what's called e-prescribing. So not only is it easier, particularly for pharmacists, to be sure about the amounts of and kinds of medications that patients are using, that which may interact with each other or cause problems or are being overused. But physicians themselves do not really have easy access. However, if we are concerned, if we hear about possibilities, it's relatively easy for us to check with a pharmacy to ask them about the records. A problem in this country with healthcare does exist in the sense that different pharmacies, I'm not sure how interactive CARS records of pharmacy is with, say, Walgreens or Walmart. So sometimes it may be a little difficult to be sure all the medications a patient's on. I'm not sure how the pharmacy records interact with that. Again, with electronic medical records and e-prescribing, that problem is beginning to be addressed and hopefully resolved. And so she also finished by what would I recommend? And as I said, I'd recommend that this be addressed and touch base with the individual you're worried about or some provider or both. I also had an email before the program came on from a patient. I'm going to use the initials since his first name is rather distinctive. It's RK writes in and he says, I think he's referring to last week's program where we talked about the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendation that PSA or prostate-specific antigen screening no longer be done. It's not really that's what it said, first off. It does suggest that in certain situations when both the patient and the physician are very clear of the risks and benefits and what you're getting and how PSA helps, then it might be individual. They particularly were addressing their questions about broad-based screening, which may lead to some issues I'll talk about here in a minute. But anyway, so the writer says, if the recommendation is no longer to do PSA screening, how are we supposed to diagnose and treat prostate cancer before it has invaded our hips and spine? It is my understanding that prostate cancer has no symptoms until it's too late in the game to initiate effective treatment. So this is email is talking about the fact that prostate cancer often will metastasize as kind of an in-game scenario and can cause quite a bit of pain and discomfort, and often that's what leads to the ending end of life, and that may be difficult to treat at that particular time. The issue that was being brought up about PSA screening is not that it's absolute. I mean, it's definitely not recommended in general screening. It is an option along with exams, biopsy, and PSAs to get information. It just has to be used effectively, and it is perhaps being overused to force studies such as biopsies and surgeries that are worse in their outcome and side effects than waiting, since many prostate cancers are slow-growing, indolent, and do not usually lead to the cause of death because of the slowness of growth. Again, that would depend on age. Again, a 40 or a 50 or even a 39-year-old who I've heard of recently with prostate cancer may be different than an 80-year-old. Part of that question that RK asked, I think, is reasonable, and I think it has to be generalized. And I think exam is still a way to determine, and I think that prostate cancers can be found before they are metastatic at times, which could be led by other symptoms of urinary tract outlet obstruction, like difficulty urinating or dribbling or hard to initiate a stream, and an examination. So hopefully I answered that question reasonably enough. Let's go ahead. I'm going to take one of the callers right now. I appreciate your call, Tom. What can we do for you? Tom, you still there? Oh, we lost time. Let's go ahead and we'll take Dick. Dick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, Dr. Woodard, what is your take on Lipitor or statins in their relationship to high levels of cholesterol in the blood? And at least in my experience, the inclination for a physician to immediately put you on Lipitor and really not discuss any alternatives like the Mediterranean diet, or at least not explore the downside of statins, you know, muscle pain, right, cognitive dysfunction, early onset of diabetes. Just wondering what your take is.
Right. Okay, so the initial and very important proviso is I have never written a prescription for Lipitor, and I don't treat adults, so it doesn't come into effect. We do screen children at times, but most of the treatment is revolves around diet, as you've talked about already. So, I'm not an expert on this issue. I hear what you're saying is that, and what I think I'm hearing you saying is that if someone automatically has a high cholesterol or high density lipoprotein, HDL or LDL, and remember that HDL is the highly desirable. You want a high HDL and a low LDL, which are the more specific issues. That there may be, why don't we talk about diet and other things reasonably? And the answer, as I understand it, is that diet can be effective, but it may not be sufficiently effective, and then other methods such as these medications that you're discussing that affect fat metabolism would be useful. So if you're saying that physicians are not offering other alternatives such as diet initially, I think that makes sense to me that it should be. My understanding is that there is a limit to how well diet will control these lipids. And that genetic or other determinants are really hard to beat. So that a lot of people are benefiting, it appears, from these medications when diet and other manipulations have not been effective. The other side of the coin is very important to discuss. There's always risks and benefits. And there are muscle disorders, problems, and other things that can happen when you're on them, and you have to balance that risk and benefit. So I guess my final answer is it gets back to just being sure you're having a good, honest discussion with your physician, about the risks and benefits overall of these medications.
All right, great. Thanks very much, sir.
You bet. All right, let's see where we are. We got lots of emails coming in. It takes me a little bit of time to get through these emails, so let me see what I got next. Here's a letter from Kevin, and he says, I'm 28, no health problems. Should I be visiting a physician or a doctor for preventative reasons? Boy, this is a very, very, very good question, in my opinion. Going to a doctor has got risks and benefits, and I'm not being facetious here. I'm not trying to belittle healthcare, but just like any treatment we've discussed, there are risks and benefits. And, you know, what physicians want to do is, believe it or not, keep you healthy. They are not necessarily being incentivized in that direction in our current health system enough, but they would like to do that as a group of people. At times, we may over-diagnose, and that is where the preventative, the idea of the recommendations of the United States Preventative Services Task Force is getting, is when and under what circumstances should we do certain tests or whatever. I really see no real terrible risk to periodically seeing a physician, even if you're healthy at age 28, not necessarily because the physical exam is going to be important. I don't think the physical exam is usually the most important thing that happens at that visit. I do think there are benefits that outweigh the risk by talking about your health, your life, your what you do, your activities, to identify things that might be at risk. Is there a family history of early bowel cancer? Is there a family history of early prostate cancer? Is there an early history of skin cancers? What kind of work do you do? What risks might be associated with it? What is your genetics otherwise? Do you really have mild asthma but have been writing it off as just a recurrent cough? There are a number of issues that with good discussions with a physician who is asking the right questions and has the time to do that is very beneficial. The physical exam often is not the answer to the question, and that's why the time is needed for these visits, in my opinion. I'm not trying to say that you should not have physical examinations. I think it's an important part, but it is probably, for most people, not the most important part. Also, at that examination or that visit with a physician, there may be discussions about what you can do to that we know really does work to help improve the quality and perhaps duration of your life, even at 28 years of age. So, yes, I think it makes sense. I'm not sure that you need a hell of a lot of testing at 28 off the on a knee-jerk visit, and then when tests are done, you really got to be able to sit down and talk about the value of the receipts of the results of that testing. All right. So, Kevin, I hope that answers your question. Let me remind listeners again, what we're doing today is taking emails and phone calls, and I'm trying to do my best to kind of give you some good, reliable information about the questions that you've had. And if I can't, I'll see if I can't point you in the right direction. If you go to line one at alaskapublic.org, we do have some links that we generally put up for all our programs, and some of which are excellent, reliable sources of information about healthcare issues. For the next 40 minutes or so, I can be reached also at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And again, the email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And it looks like people are finding that email an easier way to do things today. Here's a question from Ashley. What is your take on treating allergies proactively, she asked. The result of a blood test done on my son showed that he does have allergies, though we've not had him tested for specific allergens. A family member feels strongly that we should find out his specific allergies and have him treated with shots so that by the time he's adult, he'll outgrow it and be less allergic. I think his allergies are very minor. Only occasionally does he need to take an antihistamine. Okay, so good question. I feel very comfortable talking about this, even though I'm not an allergist. First off, allergy is the disease. It is symptoms, coughing, sneezing, itching, wheezing, sometimes vomiting and diarrhea or intestinal problems. The blood test or a skin test that is done for allergies identifies sensitization. It says for reasons that are primarily genetic, you or that your son or daughter have developed an immune response of the kind that is found in allergic individuals. There is a difference between being sensitized and having disease. For example, many, many people in this country, when screened in large numbers, have positive skin tests. I've seen numbers up to 40 to 50% of the public, but generally only about 20% really have symptoms. So it doesn't take much to figure out there is a large number of people who have false positive allergy testing. That means they are sensitized. There's nothing wrong with the test. It just means that the allergy testing does not predict symptoms. It says you may have an increased risk to those things identified with skin testing. And in particular, food allergies testing is highly very worrisome. It's not that it's not helpful, not that it can't be useful, or that it's incorrect. It's just that there are more false positives, it's felt, and pretty well documented with food. So you want to be careful. So someone who has a positive skin test and eats the food and nothing happens does not necessarily have to avoid that particular food. And I want to be careful here, because someone may have a positive skin test to peanut, may be allergic to peanut, eat something that was made with peanut oil, jumps to the conclusion that they are not allergic to peanuts, then eats something like peanut butter and has a very dangerous reaction. How can that be? The way your immune system works is it identifies proteins that have a three-dimensional structure, just like a ball of yarn or something like that, that works by lock and key. So immune cells identify these allergens and proteins by shape and size, and if they fit, then things happen. When you make a peanut oil, you heat that peanut to such a degree that the protein is changed in structure and no longer will be identified by a person's immune system, and therefore peanut oils may often be safely ingested by people with peanut allergy. However, they may still react to peanut butter or peanuts or cold pressed peanut oil, which is made by a different process. So there's a difference between sensitization and there's a difference between allergies, which is the illness. This patient, Ashley, who writes, or this writer, feels that her son's problems are mild and only occasionally needs an antihistamine, suggesting to me it's an episodic kind of exposure, often maybe to pollens like birch or alder or maybe grass in this time of the year right now in July. And certainly if that's all they need, they don't even necessarily need to see a physician. If they're sure about the diagnosis, if the medications work, they would not be a candidate for immunotherapy. The allergy shots would be more dangerous potentially than the current treatment. And so I would agree with Mom or Ashley in this situation, where probably an antihistamine is all that's needed. The next question or comment is so that someone has told her that if they take the shots, that the person will grow out of their allergy, will be less allergic. It is true that immunotherapy is better than it has been in the past, often works. My understanding here, there may be some proviso, but it works. They work best with single allergens, people who are multiply allergic, and that includes a large number of people are getting immunotherapy. It may not be quite as effective, but it's still more effective than it used to be. So there's no guarantee that you'll outgrow it, that you'll get better with time, but many do. I think they are effective. I want you to hear what I'm saying for sure. The other side of the coin is there may relapse. The duration of effectiveness is somewhere around 10 years, and it is my understanding that later you can begin to have symptoms again in some people. It's often not a big issue. Now, what if you don't treat people? What happens to them? I don't know all the statistics, but what I will say is we know that nuts, peanuts, and shellfish, only about 12% of people ever outgrow that allergen in some of the best testing. Perennial allergens like dogs and cats and dust mites are not commonly outgrown. But I do believe, and I think I have seen children outgrow pollen allergy, at least particularly with boys. It seems to me that as they approach adolescence, many boys who have had significant seasonal allergies in the past seem to do better. I do not know why. That's an observation, and I may not have the best evidence for that, but it's my understanding, and I believe I've read that that is true and seen some evidence to that. So if there are allergists listening and want to make a comment or straighten me out, I'm more than happy to do that. But that's how I would answer that that question. I'm going to take a phone call from Eric, and then we'll probably have to try to take a break here. Eric, you're on line one.
Hi, doctor.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Tell me, my sister recently had a child, and I wonder about updates to immunizations in the family.
Okay.
Particularly whooping cough.
Yeah. For yourself, are you talking about our immediate family? This was your sister, you said, that had the daughter?
Yes, but for son. Mm. But for both myself and family, she's cared for by her doctor, I'm sure.
Okay. I'm going to give you a little bit longer answer than you want because I think this is really, really, really important information. Pertussis, or whooping cough, is a unusual organism. It does not, almost any infection you have in your lifetime, you generate a lifelong immunity to, with few exceptions. Whooping cough is not that. So if a mother is born who had measles or got a measles vaccine, if we measure the antibody to measles in a newborn right at birth, it'll be exactly the same as it is in the mother. However, that baby does not continue to generate these immune response. He or she doesn't have the cells that do that. They don't have the memory cells. So by 6 months, there's much less protective antibody to measles than the mother would now have still at 6 months. So that's what nature has done. It provides a way for children, newborns, to be protected for a while. First off, pertussis is an exception to that rule. Newborn infants are not born with protection to whooping cough, even if their mother has very good protection. Second, whooping cough, because it's such an unusual organism and its ability to evade the immune response, is not likely, like smallpox, to ever be eradicated by the use of the vaccines. What the vaccines do is they decrease some likelihood of being infected. They decrease the severity of the illness. So now what we know we can do, what will happen, is if an infant who is unprotected gets whooping cough in the first couple of months of life, that is a life-threatening infection that can cause death. And there have been a number of deaths, particularly in the West part of the United States, in Utah and Washington and Oregon, and California. So first off, babies need the immunization early, and it takes two, at a minimum, maybe three immunizations, which need to be given at least a month to 6 weeks apart before they're fully immunized. So that infants, as you're implying, are very susceptible to the potential of getting whooping cough if they're exposed to someone who has whooping cough early in life. And that leads to the recommendation, and again, because of the contagiousness, because of the effectiveness of the vaccine does not last for long periods of time, about every 10 years, we ought to be thinking about getting another dose of vaccine. To get to your question specifically, if you've not had a dose of whooping cough vaccine since you were 11 or 12 years of age, and certainly within the last 10 years, it would be best for that baby for you to get immunized. Therefore, you would now be less likely to get it, and that's what we call cocooning. It's the idea that we're going to protect babies who are otherwise have no immunity until three doses of the vaccine in the first 6 months of life. And so it makes it less likely you're going to spread it to the baby. Now, how could you spread it? Well, if you've got partial immunity, you may have a cough that is, for all intents and purposes, unrecognized, be very difficult to tell, and unfortunately, we would know when the baby got very, very ill. So I've just addressed the whooping cough vaccine, and I would say that's one of the most important reasons and the most important thing for you to be considering as a near relative. Other vaccines, off the top of my head, are maybe not as important to the baby's standpoint as the pertussis vaccine for yourself.
Thank you, doctor.
All right. Thank you. This has been going too fast. We got a lot of phone calls. I need to take a short break. We're going to be back in, maybe a minute or so and continue to discuss your questions and comments. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm taking and fielding questions about your concerns or questions that you have that would like addressed. And I'm going to do my best to try to give you the best answer I can for these. If you've got questions or comments during the next 15 or 20 minutes, you can send them directly to us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free outside number is 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evenings, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and you won't be able to call or email with questions at that time. Also, please remember you can go to KSKA or alaskapublic.org and look for the Line 1 link and see or listen to previous email or podcasts on topics that you might be interested in at any time. Next question comes from Tom, and he says, thanks for your show. You've had several shows on healthcare costs. How do you decide what to charge your patients? Do you charge about the same as other Anchorage doctors, and why is it a lot more than it is in Seattle? These are not particularly easy question to answer. I can't look and see what other doctors charge in Anchorage. That would get me into issues like collusion and price fixing. So we go out of our way not to see what other doctors charge. Occasionally, sometimes patients tell us what our charges are. My decision to make charge patients are really done by a medical administrator. They are looking at what insurance companies reimburse for certain amounts of different charges. There are ways they can see what Medicaid or Medicare and different insurances will charge, but everyone has to be charged the same way. I frankly have very little personal input on what the charges are. I have people who come up with that information and say, this is what we would recommend we do, and we think about it a little bit. We do not want to overcharge. We don't want to terribly undercharge for our services. So I hate to be maybe not as specific, but that's exactly how we do it in our office. Why is it a lot more than in Seattle? That is a good question. We've tried to address that recently. I think healthcare costs in general are definitely more expensive here than in Seattle. And I'm not sure there's absolutely a good reason. I'm not sure that the costs here are a lot more. I think the net income of many physicians in Anchorage or Alaska may be more than it is in other parts of the country. So even though we do charge more, I think the physicians here may be making a little bit more. But I don't know that for a fact. It's just some information that I've been led to believe. So I don't know why we necessarily why it is a lot more. I can't answer that specific question, but I think that is true. Take another email. Here's a question. It looks like about leg cramps. I'm a 68-year-old white male, 6'1", 250. I get leg pain cramps at bed occasionally, sometimes in both legs. It's excruciating. What's the cause and treatment? This is sent by Tom. Tom, I am 64, 5'10", 190, and I get leg cramps almost very often. I think it is partly age and conditioning. Mine definitely happen more when I'm more active, and I've walked or hiked more than usual or done more activity. I think the idea that it's a potassium deficiency, which I've heard, or that you need, I can't remember what the medication that's frequently people have taken over the counter maybe for this, but I think it's just basically an overuse and overactivity problem. It is extremely painful. I have to get up out of bed and walk around to get the muscle spasms from happening. If I'm not very active, it doesn't happen. I don't think it means anything by itself particularly badly. You can, there are people who have vascular disease that's leading to less blood supply to the muscles, and that may be a factor, but I think that typically causes more pain during the activity, limiting activity and movement. So, Tom, I wish I could answer more about that. It's a little bit out of my expertise other than it's a personal problem, and I think it's an extremely common problem, and particularly maybe men as they age. Here is a question that says, do I have any advice for a persistent itch directly in the rectum first thing in the morning? It's not unusual to have perianal itching. It is possible that is related to hemorrhoids or other fissures in the rectum. In children, we sometimes think about pinworms, which are relatively benign issues. No one likes to think that they may have pinworms, but that can cause some rectal itching, particularly often in children at night before they go to bed. If you haven't seen a physician about the problem, I think it's worthwhile doing to see if you can get rid of the absolute cause. But I think that's one where it may take an examination, a further discussion with physicians. Those are a couple of common reasons that I would raise that may be noted, however. Here's another question from an individual would rather keep herself anonymous. I found out my midwife discussed my labor with a mutual acquaintance of ours. I thought there was a confidentiality clause. Is this allowed? Yep, they should not talk about your medical situation with anybody else without your express permission. Sometimes people get mad at me because I'm so conscious of this problem. I don't talk about anybody in my family may have known. Sometimes they want to know if Joe or Jack or Bob saw me today, and because they're friends, and I don't answer even that question to stay away from this kind of problem. But you're right, they should not be talking about your problems with anybody else without your permission. Here's a question from Steve. It says, I've experienced some hip and buttocks pain for about 6 to 7 years. I've been diagnosed with myofascial pain, fascial pain. The doctor who diagnosed the condition says there's no sure treatment. I've passed on some injection treatment. I've tried massage therapy, physical therapy, acupuncture, stretching, low inflammation diets, exercise, and yoga, all no help. I'm able to sit comfortably, ride a bike, or travel without having to suffer through the experience. I'm unable to sit comfortably, ride a bike, or travel. Any ideas? Nope. I got to be frank with you. This is one where it sounds to me where you still need to be seeking out an exact diagnosis. I don't know what the problem is. My thoughts would be orthopedic in origin, sometimes neurologic. One way to tell if it's neurologic pain, I think it's fair to say, is if pain medications have very little effect, particularly like Advil and so forth, it suggests there may be a neuropathic or a neurologic source to that, particularly if there was a lot of significant fasciculations, that is, the muscles seem to move very like a bag of worms in your leg or your hip, that would suggest nerve injury. If you're losing a lot of strength in the leg, that might indicate some nerve injury if there's radiation of the pain into the lower leg. or whether it could be a hip. And whether the diagnosis of myofascial pain is correct, I can't answer it. And I would have to say you need to keep looking and looking for advice. This gets to the point of where do you go to find it? I think you have to go to some physicians, either a pain specialist or perhaps an orthopedist and perhaps a neurologist. I wish I could be more specific. I think going to the internet will not be helpful. I think it's a great place to be if you've got a good diagnosis. Trying to make a diagnosis on your own on the internet, and internet can be very, very, very difficult and often just makes it hard to do, and that's even for physicians. There's times when I'll go and look up a group of symptoms trying to see if there's something else I need to think about, and it's really, really, really difficult to do. However, it's extremely helpful once I've got a precise and very certain diagnosis. Greg, you're on line one. What can I do for you?
Some questions about my 12-year-old daughter who has a reaction to sun exposure, which is both winter and summer. Basically, she gets not quite blistering, but hives and itching on the exposed area.
Yeah.
And face, trunk, feet, if she's wearing flip-flops. We do cover-ups. We do SPF 30, UV protective clothing. I'm just curious, you have specifically what?
Yeah. It sounds like this is, it may be a polymorphous, polymorphous light eruption reaction it's called. It's what it may sound like. You're doing all the right things. I have heard Dr. Jeff Demain recently, one of the allergists in town, discuss this, and I believe it's true, but you may want to look up this on the internet, polymorphous light eruption, that you can also pre-expose to ultraviolet light a little bit, and it kind of desensitizes before. So doing some things before you go on a vacation or when you're having that exposure. Other than that, I don't know what else to tell you. The other thing that's coming out about this, the SPFs, a 15 gives you about 94% protection against ultraviolet B radiation, I believe it is. The SPF 30 is up to about 97-98%. And the FDA is going to require people to tell you that because it's not much bang for your buck. So getting an SPF 50 or 90, if it's available, you don't get much more bang for your buck. So it sounds like you're doing the right thing with the protective SPF sunscreen, too.
Well, okay. Appreciate your help.
You bet. Here is a email from a woman who says she's a senior and she can urinate 3 to 4 times during the day, but then need to awaken 2 or 3 hours at night to avoid. I suspect she doesn't say what's the reason for that. First off, many people would think maybe it's diabetes, and that's a possibility, although usually I would think you'd have other symptoms of diabetes other than just having to get up frequently, and it suggests to me that there's bladder dysfunction that's going on here, and if she's older, it could have some neurologic implications. There could be something pressing on the bladder. I don't mean to scare you. I don't know for sure what it is, but I think it is some signs of bladder dysfunction, and probably a urologist would be the right person to address that issue if you wanted to. There may be medications that help. There may be some other things, but it is not an unusual problem. And I will go ahead and mention, although I know you're a woman, it's not an uncommon symptom in men who are developing a large prostate. It could be prostatic cancer, but usually it's in a large prostate that may also lead men to frequently awaken at night. And also, I guess it makes common sense to avoid, you know, drinking a lot before you go to bed at night. But even if you do that, it may be that you're still going to have that need to get up and urinate. I might mention while I'm thinking about it, on the other end of the spectrum, particularly boys have nighttime bedwetting well into later childhood. Often about 10% of boys will have to will bedwet at night, even at school entry. And again, it implies that this is a kind of a sleep disorder. The kids either usually are very, very deep sleepers. There's some evidence they may have smaller bladders. My experience has been they almost all are very, very, very deep sleepers. And because of that, they either don't get the message or they get the message and are just too tired to get up and get out of bed. Bladder training apparatuses, things that you put on that form a buzzer, or particularly nowadays we use vibrating things. If the diaper starts to get wet or the underwear, then it triggers a vibrator that wakes the child up and they have to do something, is the most effective treatment, particularly by 5, 6, 7 years of age. And it said about 70% of kids can be trained out of night waking using these things once they hit 6 or 7 years of age, if they use it for 3 months. I'm kind of trained of thought there, so I hope that that helped with that question for numbers of different people. So let me remind our listeners again, we got about 5 or 7 more minutes. If you want to call or email, I'll try. We've got a couple more emails I'm going to try to get through. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. There's another question regarding health care costs and billing. It says, what are your thoughts on the cost and complexity of health care billing, especially from the point of view of the private practice physician? In the current health care debate, there is a lot of talk about price fixing, comparing, I guess, with Medicare being an unfair burden to physicians. But it seems like the complexity of our healthcare billing industry is a huge waste of money. Do you have any thoughts on why it's so complicated and how we could streamline and help reduce our country's healthcare industry? Yeah, there's a couple of things I've read recently with pretty good statistics to support this. One is a surprising number is that if you took all the healthcare profits, all the profits from insurance companies, and pulled them together, it would still be less than 0.5%. That's the profits of health care insurers of our yearly health care bill. So the profits of health care insurance companies are not a significant part of our problem. However, the overhead, which includes the billing costs, are a significant issue. If you define that as the premiums you pay in minus what's left over after insurance companies pay the bill, some recent information that I saw was that that is about 20%, so that there's a 20% overhead. That is very significant compared to almost every other country in the world, which somewhere is in the neighborhood of 7, 8, 9%. So that countries where there is more control over health care costs and so forth, and often less health insurance companies, then that number comes down. It is also said that Medicare is very efficient, and I read in the same document that it's about 7%, and the argument was made in the discussion that Medicare is much more efficient than the private insurance company. However, it went on to state that the exact costs of Medicare's overhead, or costs for billing and administrative costs, may not really be 7%, because, for example, the Internal Revenue Service, I think, is in charge of collecting costs. So we're not comparing apples with oranges necessarily. So my overall understanding is that the costs of health care, that the overhead of various and sundry insurance companies is an issue, but not their profits. Why is it so complicated? Because that's what we in this country have decided we wanted to do. We want to have multiple independent companies that are doing the insurance. The other point, and it doesn't mean that it has to stay that way, but that's what we've elected to live with so far. This same article went out of its way to point out that often the complaint is that our country doesn't, we don't want our country to become socialized in medicine, and it points out that we already spend more per capita of government intake funds on Medicare, Medicaid, and other government health care than any other country in the world. So if that's a division, a definition of socialism, then we socialized medicine, then we already are worse than other countries. And that doesn't include the private health insurance. So I think in my mind, one of the things that probably needs to be adjusted, I don't know the right answer to our problem. I just think we need to do something about the increasing percentage of our economic well-being is being taken up by health care costs needs to be done. But I think the incentives need to be changed. I think there's pretty good evidence that large physician specialist groups like the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, and others who are on salary, their incentives to save money, not waste money, and to address the preventative aspects of health care are better than our current fee-for-service arrangement. And that may be where we will end up. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to have a single payer, per se. I'm going to try one more question before we get too far here. Prescription monitoring. Just a quick note on the previous question regarding the connection between providers and prescriptions. There's a program in the state to monitor the use of control medication for an individual patient throughout the state, no matter who prescribes it. All pharmacies are required to participate. It's a prescription drug monitoring program. So all pharmacists, so you just have to register to have access. So that's a better answer than I gave previously about the fact that pharmacists are able to keep track of particularly controlled substances like narcotics for pain medication. Let's see if I can get another one here. Is there a provider and clinic in town who specializes in head injury, sports-related concussions, and after-accident care? I think any of the adult or pediatric neurologists in town would be the right place to go. That's generally where people would go with that. Neurosurgeons would be involved if there's surgical reasons to do anything else. There are some physical therapists and many that are interested in this, but for head injuries and related concussions, either a good generalist is a place to start, like a pediatrician or an internist, or seeing a neurologist would be where I would go to answer that question, particularly since it was after an accident. All right. We're coming up to the end of the program. I don't think I have time to answer another question. I think these questions were excellent. I hope you enjoyed this approach, and I'd encourage people to go to our website if you'd like to find links to good to other sites. There's so much information out there on the Internet that is not valid, and it's very difficult to get good information. I would heed my warning that it's a bad place to go if you're trying to make a diagnosis. It's a much, much better place to go if you have a diagnosis. Keep an open mind about what you read. It's probably a good idea to discuss it with physicians. If you find something you're worried about, tell them where you got the information. Give them the chance to edit or tell you other places to go to look at for the correct information or more reliable information. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can continue this on KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, where we'll be discussing different types of psychotherapy, how each of these works, what makes a good patient for psychologists, and what makes a good therapist. We'll be answering your questions as well with my guest, Anchorage psychologist, Dr. Kevin O'Leary. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, July 23rd on KSKA. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor, our audio engineer as well. Thanks for listening, and thanks for the questions. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.